The Tom Woods Show, episode 1954.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, don't even think about missing the libertarian event of the year. The 2000th episode of The Tom Woods Show, live in Orlando, featuring many of your favorites from The Tom Woods Show. And Michael Malice says his special surprise guest, whose identity I myself don't even know, will bring the house down. Cost nothing to attend. Register at tomwoods2000.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. We're joined today by Joseph Cotto, who, along with Paul Gottfried, another friend of the Tom Woods Show, hosts Cotto Gottfried, a current events podcast that I think listeners of this program will enjoy. I'll link to it on the show notes page. And we're going to talk to him about his new book, released just this summer, Runaway Masters, A True Story of Slavery, Freedom, Triumph, and Tragedy, Beyond 1619 and 1776. Joseph, welcome to the show.
Very glad to be here, Tom. Thank you for having me on.
I wonder if we could start actually with an update on how Paul Gottfried is doing. The two of you have a program, Cotto Gottfried, together, and I had been hoping to get him back on the program where he's been numerous times, and then I heard the bad news.
He had a run-in, literally, with some fellow who was driving his car in Paul's neighborhood. Paul was bicycling down to get the paper on Sunday morning, not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before that. And this guy just ran right into him, and Paul went up on the hood of his car. It was a terrible situation. And Paul wound up in the hospital, obviously, but he actually was able to walk back home, which people were absolutely shocked about, his family, his doctor. And as it turns out, his doctor is a fan of his anyway. So,
How about that?
Yeah, Paul got great care. And he's back at home now, but he has titanium ribs. And he's recovering as nicely as one can. I just spoke with him yesterday. Even though he's in a great deal of pain, he's very glad to be alive.
Yeah.
And he's very much looking forward to getting back to work, not only with Cotto Gottfried, but of course with the Charlemagne Institute, which publishes Chronicles Magazine, where he's the chief editor. So he's in pain, he's recovering, but he's really chomping at the bit to get back to normal.
Was it a hit and run? Did the car just drive off?
Yes.
Holy cow. That is unbelievable.
It's crazy.
Unbelievable.
And he lives in a beautiful area. There's typically not problems with that, but you know, bad things can happen anywhere, unfortunately.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, I'm glad at least he's at home and that he'll be returning to what he does best in the near future. All right, so let's talk about your book. You know, obviously there's whether or not somebody, let's say, taking on a project like this intended it, there's a political aspect to a story like this, because slavery, the very subject of slavery, is very, very difficult to discuss these days without a political undertone. And I think the average person, like the average, let's say 20-year-old, probably does not have any idea how widespread slavery has been throughout the history of civilization. Or that I think it's only 5% of the slave trade occurred coming over to the Americas that actually wound up in the United States. So people have this impression that the United States is somehow uniquely evil. Now, I think obviously everybody should own up to things that they've done wrong. There's nothing wrong with that. But if it's distorted in order to score political points, I don't think that really does a lot of good. So anyway, anytime you talk about this kind of topic, there is this political undertone. You're talking about slavery in this book. You're talking about the Spanish. You're talking to some degree about the British, talking about Americans, and you're talking about the Seminoles. In 1 minute, what's the story that all these components put together will be telling?
Well, it's a story essentially of survival, what people do, different groups do in order to survive. And obviously, it's the individuals within these groups that engage in specific actions. And whether it's the British, whether it's the Americans, the Spaniards, or the Seminoles, these groups want to prosper, and they do what they believe is necessary to prosper. And my book essentially tells the story of human survival. And unfortunately, slavery is politicized, as you mentioned, but very early on in the book, I mentioned how ridiculous this is, because slavery is part of the human story of survival, a very negative part of it, but a part of it all the same. And it is fascinating to see how different groups interact with each other, each group trying to obviously survive. And what comes about as a result of their interactions is a very complex history that I hope I've related quite easily for folks to understand. But all the same, it is something else in every way conceivable.
Well, let's start with a little bit of the history of Florida and the people there and who controlled it and how it wound up in American hands. Can you tell us that story? And then let's talk about the history of the Seminoles.
Well, Florida obviously was controlled by the Spanish for hundreds of years from the 1560s until the 1760s. The British then bought it from the Spaniards. The Spaniards did not run their Florida colonies well at all. They searched for gold. They tried to convert the natives, and they just got problem after problem. And the British really tried to develop the land. And the British brought a measure of prosperity to Florida, which had never been seen. And that worked out well for the white man and the American Indian man alike. And as a result, Florida remained loyal to Britain during the American Revolution. It's the only part of the 50 states today which remained loyal to the crown during the Revolution. And after the American Revolution, however, Florida was unaffordable for Britain, so it sold it back to Spain. But Spain itself was going through some serious problems then, not just in terms of its empire, but even at home. And pretty soon, the monarchy itself was abolished, and then it was brought back again. But anyway, so Spain, in its second colonial period, did not have the resources or the wherewithal to run Florida very well. And the Americans really, really, really wanted it for different reasons, but I think national pride was the biggest concern. But of course, there were these American Indians here, and they were different from the ones that were originally here. The Spaniards, through various means, killed off the original American Indian inhabitants of Florida, but the Seminoles were runaways from the Creek Indians of what's now Alabama and Georgia, and then other tribes joined in with them here in Florida. And these runaways came down into British or Spanish Florida, and outside of certain settlements, Florida was very much wilderness, and nobody could really tell the Seminoles what to do, and they set up their own society in Florida. And then when the Americans came about, when they got Florida from the Spaniards, the Americans wanted to go much further than the British had in terms of development. The Americans wanted to actually have the state from one end to the other as a territory originally, then it became a state. They wanted to make it their own, and that meant pushing the Seminoles onto a reservation. And then after that, Andrew Jackson decided that all of the American Indians should be shipped out to what's now Oklahoma. It was called the Arkansas Territory back then. And the Seminoles obviously did not want to go. And that set off some very, very brutal conflicts. Actually, there was conflict originally, even when Florida was still part of Spain. There was the first Seminole War that lasted for a few years in the 18-teens, if that makes any sense. But then in the 1830s was the biggest of all the Seminole Wars, the second one. And then there were a series of small skirmishes going toward the Civil War, actually. Not during the Civil War period, but that was in the 1850s. So there was a lot of conflict between the Americans and the Seminoles, even before Florida became American. And it's because the Americans really wanted to have Florida as their own, not just in a few communities, but they wanted to settle the entire state. And as a result of these Seminole Wars, you and I are having this conversation right now from Florida, because if the Americans hadn't won the Seminole Wars, there never would have been any sort of widespread American settlement of the Florida Peninsula. So it's really something else. It's fascinating, but it's very often overlooked.
All right, let's turn now to how it is that the Seminoles wound up having ownership of slaves. Now, when they had these slaves, they weren't engaged in the kind of brutal and merciless agricultural labor that slaves might have been involved in the rest of the American South. But slaves they nevertheless were. So what were the circumstances here?
It was a form of slavery that was more similar to European feudalism than chattel slavery, which is what you would see on American plantations. The Seminoles took in runaways from chattel slavery. The runaways would come from Georgia initially, then they start coming from other areas in the South. And the Seminoles took these people into bondage. But the form of bondage which the Seminoles practiced was one where the slaves got to have their own communities where they were able to govern themselves within the context of Seminole law. It's not like they were independent, but they were able to do their own thing on a day-to-day basis, at least. However, they had to give a certain portion of their annual crop to the Seminole tribe. And if they didn't do this, then the Seminole would deal with them very severely. But there were very, very little conflict because these slaves were just so happy to no longer be forced into the chattel slavery that they had run from. And it was interesting because obviously when they were in Florida, whether it was ruled by the British or the Spaniards, slavery was legal. It was practiced by the Europeans, but nobody went after these slaves had by the Seminoles until the Americans came about. Now, the Americans had a really big issue with the Seminoles and their slaves because they viewed these slaves as stolen property. And they believed that the Seminoles were not only in possession of stolen property, but profiting off of it. And so the Americans really, really wanted their slaves back. And obviously, I'm referring to what's happened after the United States came into being. And that caused a great deal of problems between the Seminoles and the Americans. It was certainly an aggravating factor in what created the Seminole Wars. And it was an aggravating factor during the Seminole Wars because rather than, you know, return to slavery, they called themselves Black Seminoles, among other things, but the Seminoles just saw them as slaves. But a lot of the slaves and the Seminoles came to adopt a sort of Seminole identity. It's kind of hard to describe, and it's a very controversial matter into the present day for matters that I think we'll get to in a little bit. But anyway, the Seminole wound up using his people who were his slaves as soldiers against the Americans during the Second Seminole War. And the Americans were then really vexed because they could deal with defeat, at least at a certain time, by American Indians who were very, especially the Seminoles, outstanding warriors who were able to take down many American soldiers for every one, you know, Seminole killed by Uncle Sam. But for the U.S. Army to be losing to runaway slaves, that was something else entirely. So there was a sort of shame or honor aspect added to the Seminole Wars because of that, at least insofar as the Americans viewed it. And the whole situation was really fascinating. But the Seminole slaves, just to recap before I throw it back to you, it was very different from the chattel slavery, which the Europeans and some American Indian tribes, by the way, practiced. But it was still slavery. Some people have tried to minimize it. Typically, for purposes of political correctness, they don't like to talk about non-white slave owners. So they say, no, they were really more partners, the Seminoles and their slaves, but they weren't. Under Seminole law, if you were born into slavery, you were a slave. And they viewed their slaves as outsiders to the Seminole tribe, which is something that's caused, as I said, a lot of issues right up into the present day.
What happens with the slaves? Of course, in the 1830s, the so-called five civilized tribes were targeted for relocation. And a great many of them were moved out to Oklahoma, around there. What happened to the slaves during that time? Did they bring them?
Well, what happened was that after the Seminoles were initially moved to a reservation in Florida, it was declared by Uncle Sam that as part of the treaty which allowed this to happen, the slaves that they owned could not come with them. And what, you know, a lot of these slaves did then was live in these little sort of bands, either on the reservation or just outside of it. And they were evading Uncle Sam as well as the Seminoles, because the Seminoles were tasked by Uncle Sam with retrieving whatever slaves they found and returning them to Uncle Sam, who would then try to find their owner, or if the owner couldn't be found, he would make a lot of money selling them at a slave auction. And that, I think, was the federal government's real motivation here, making money in that way. And there was a lot of money to be made because the transatlantic slave trade in the U.S. was abolished. And that made domestic slavery much, much more important in terms of, I'm trying to use a nice word here, but having slave babies that would provide for slave labor in future generations. It made domestic slaves much more valuable. So Uncle Sam had a huge profit margin by getting the slaves and the Seminoles away from them. But anyway, what eventually happened was that a lot of these Seminole slaves or ex-slaves wound up not being captured by Uncle Sam. And when the time came for the Second Seminole War in the 1830s, when Uncle Sam wanted to move the Seminoles to what's now Oklahoma, the Seminoles formed an alliance with their ex-slaves, and they both fought the U.S. together, and they were remarkably effective. The Seminoles were better warriors than their ex-slaves, but at the same time, their ex-slaves were pretty well trained. And now this is where things get really dicey, because Uncle Sam did promise the Seminole ex-slaves, the Black Seminoles, whatever one wants to call them, he promised them freedom if they would agree to self-deport to what's now Oklahoma. And when the Seminoles learned about this, this happened during the Second Seminole War, they went berserk and they threatened to really, really, really unleash carnage upon the Americans, that they were already bitterly in war with each other. So you can only imagine how bad things would have gone. And Uncle Sam was terrified by this. And he eventually yanked the promise of freedom to the Seminole slaves and this, or the ex-slaves. And this left these Black Seminoles, whatever, in a very bad position, because they now had to go to Oklahoma without freedom being guaranteed to them, because if they stayed in Florida, the Seminoles would have just killed them all. They would have regarded them as traitors, which they were technically under Seminole law. So it was very interesting and very tragic how this played out. But once the Seminole ex-slaves were in Oklahoma, what happened there was that they were brought into slavery by other American Indian tribes, particularly the Creeks, who then allied with the Seminoles who had been resettled to Oklahoma to get these ex-slaves back into bondage. And some of them, some of the ex-slaves, you know, they just wouldn't put up with it. And they ran away to Mexico with a few Seminole traditionalists who did not want to consent to rule by the Creeks, because Uncle Sam left the Seminoles to be ruled by the Creeks in Oklahoma, which was a very difficult situation, needless to say, since the Seminoles had originally sprang from the Creeks by and large. So it was very awkward, even under the best of circumstances. But generally, the Seminole and the Creek patched things up. But those Black Seminoles who remained in Oklahoma, who didn't go to Mexico, they were, in the end, all of them were put back into slavery. And that was chattel slavery. So their ancestors, or they themselves, had fled chattel slavery. They wound up in a more, you can't really say, pseudo-humane form of slavery. Then they were given a form of de facto freedom to fight the Americans. And then the Americans promised them actual freedom. And then that was yanked away from them, but they still were deported anyhow. And when they got to their new promised land, so to speak, they were put back into chains, or they were forced to leave the country entirely. So it was really this sort of gothic horror type tale, really, but it's something that's not spoken of all that much. But it does show how slavery was something inflicted on people by members of different races, because both the American Indian and the European created the situation which I'm communicating to you here. And, you know, with present narratives of slavery, which basically boil down to, I call it white man evil, the white man did everything wrong, but everyone else is blameless. This sort of situation, as nuanced, as complicated as it is, a lot of folks wouldn't want to hear it. They want it to be much more simpler than the story actually reveals itself to be.
Obviously, most of the Seminoles moved west, but some stayed behind, or some managed to stay in Florida. So what were the circumstances that they were just resisting?
Exactly. What happened was that the Seminole was pushed farther and farther south into Florida. Originally, the Seminole started out in northern Florida, but then he was pushed into the deep into the peninsula, and eventually he was pushed into the Everglades, or, you know, areas just north of it. And this was during the Third Seminole War, where by this time the Seminoles were all south of the Peace River. And for those who know southwestern Florida, like Arcadia, that area, that the Peace River is around there. And so the Seminoles were south of that. But the Americans, who were content to leave them there, virtually with most of the Seminoles having been deported to what's now Oklahoma, a few U.S. soldiers, for whatever reason, began to antagonize the Seminoles, and they interfered negatively with one of their farms. And then the Seminoles retaliated by successfully attacking a U.S. military outpost near Fort Myers. And that set off a series of tit-for-tat conflicts, which lasted for a few years. But the end result of this Third Seminole War was that only about 200 to 400 Seminoles remained in Florida. And the ones who were there for the Third Seminole War were holdouts anyway, because the overwhelming majority of Seminoles had been sent at the conclusion of the Second Seminole War to Oklahoma. So you have a minority of a minority who wound up staying in Florida, and they retreated so deep into the Everglades that they are in what is now the Big Cypress Swamp. That's where they resolved to live, and Uncle Sam let them stay there because the land was worthless. And so the Seminoles had to get by basically fishing, you know, shooting whatever game was around. And there obviously wasn't much of it in the Everglades. There wasn't a lot of solid land for animals to move around on. So these last few hundred Seminoles are the forefathers of today's Seminole tribe of Florida. And today's Seminole tribe of Florida, ironically, turned out much better than the Seminole tribe of Oklahoma, financially speaking. They have many lucrative real estate and otherwise business investments. And the Seminole tribe of Florida and the members of it today get thousands of dollars each month just for being Seminoles. Out in Oklahoma, they have no such economic, they have no such economic prosperity, even though they're not doing, you know, terribly bad for themselves. But the Seminole tribe of Florida, for all it suffered throughout the ages, it certainly did manage to rebound considerably in the present day.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Blinkist. Here's how in a very short period of time, you can become more confident, more knowledgeable, feel better about yourself, feel in command of conversations, social situations, and the like. Blinkist takes top nonfiction titles, pulls out the key takeaways, and puts them into text and audio explainers called Blinks that give you the most important information from these books in just 15 minutes. So you can use Blinks to learn about philosophy, history, science, but also psychology, health and nutrition, or personal growth. You've got thousands of titles and 27 categories of knowledge to choose from. You'll recall when I was out for a few days, I had Stephen Kinsella guest host a couple episodes of The Tom Woods Show, and he has been raving about Blinkist in recent weeks, saying it's a tremendously easy and convenient way to amass knowledge. And that's why I like it too, because in 15 minutes, just driving to the store, I can consume the equivalent of an entire book. And by the way, it's not just books that have been released in the past week or so. You can read books from centuries ago, like Machiavelli's The Prince or Letters from a Stoic by Seneca. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. What brought about the Third Seminole War?
It was, like I said, after most Seminoles had been relocated, there were these holdouts who were allowed to live.
Okay, so that's the third. Okay, I got it. Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it turns out then that, I guess this isn't super surprising, that during the, well, whatever you want to call the Civil War, we got like 12 possible names for it. For simplicity's sake, we'll call it the Civil War. I know it's not accurate, all that stuff. But there was an alliance between that the Seminoles sided with the Confederacy.
Right.
And they weren't alone among American Indians, by the way, in doing so. And of course, what that means is that when the war is over, they are viewed with even less sympathy than they were before.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because if you look at Osceola, who was the greatest of all Seminole warriors, he was actually viewed in his time when he was big in the 1830s. He was viewed with extreme reverence by the Americans, even those who were trying to kill him. He became something of a, you wouldn't necessarily say a folk hero. Well, he was certainly to his people, but nationally, he was certainly a figure of reverence, like a revered enemy. And he was popular up until his death, even when he was in jail up in South Carolina at Fort Moultrie. There were people coming to see him and to paint his picture, and his guards felt honored to be in his presence. And he actually was given funeral with full military honors and a marble gravestone, which is there to this day. But so the Seminoles were, even though the federal government treated them terribly, even though it manipulated them, even though it evicted them, it still did look upon them with a great deal of respect, not just Osceola, but the tribe on the whole. That sort of respect which the European had for the Seminole is why you have so many places today in Florida named after the Seminole tribe and its dignitaries. Now, looking at the situation in Oklahoma, I just had to throw all that out there to set the stage for it. The Seminole, even though he was treated as the enemy, he was respected, but because he sided with the Confederacy in the Civil War, he just became the outright enemy. By the end of the Civil War, the respect was gone, at least among Northerners, among those who fought for the Union. Among Southerners, the respect was still there, but obviously Southerners were powerless at the end of the Civil War, so that was that. But so the federal government imposed upon the Seminole a treaty renegotiation for their reservation in Oklahoma. And part of that was that the Seminole had to liberate all of his slaves. And these slaves had to be given citizenship on the reservation, which is different from tribal membership, but they had to be given the citizenship. And the Seminole was livid about this, but he had no choice. I mean, there was nothing he could really do. And so that's what began what's called the Freedman. And they're still called Freedmen. This is the legal name of the Black Seminoles under Seminole law in Oklahoma. And the Freedman and the Seminole have coexisted very, very uneasily since the 1860s.
All right, so here we are in the 1860s, and we get to, in effect, the end of the story involving slavery. Mm-hmm. What do we walk away with from this story with?
Well, it's interesting because the story goes on, I think, even before you can walk away, because the result of these slaves being liberated means that they had to live among the Seminoles. The Seminoles don't want them there. And in the early 1900s, there are two different tribal roles, one for Seminoles and whites who married into the Seminole tribe, and then another for the Black Seminoles. And over time, the Black Seminoles in Oklahoma are given their own bands within the tribe. The Seminole Tribe of Oklahoma is governed by bands who have representatives on the tribal council, and it's a segregated society. And in Florida, there are very, very few Black Seminoles, obviously. There are only about, to this day, 4,000 Seminoles in Florida, but there are about 50, or give or take, 50 Black Seminoles living on a reservation near Fort Pierce. And these folks have their own reservation. They have no representation on the tribal council. They wanted an elected representative on the council, or to the council, liaison, but they didn't get that. And so they are segregated from the Seminole tribe as well, even though they have tribal membership, unlike the Black Seminoles in Oklahoma. So whether you look at Florida or whether you look at Oklahoma, you see a story of slavery, really, that did not end with slavery. It comes into the present day. It's kind of hard to walk away from it at all. But what it is in both cases is that the Seminoles, whether they're in Oklahoma or Florida, they want to maintain their tribal cohesion. They want to exist as a definable people, and they want to pass on their history, their heritage, and their culture, really, into the next generation. And they view any outsider as obviously an obstacle to that. Not the outsider in and of himself, but if the outsider tries to lay some claim to Seminole society, they obviously don't respond terribly well to that. And so it creates a situation with these Black Seminoles who say that they are Seminoles, they've been with their families have been with the Seminoles for hundreds of years. Why aren't we considered to be part of your tribe? This is out in Oklahoma, at least. In Florida, they do have tribal membership because there are so few of them that they really can't make a difference in the tribe. But in Oklahoma, where they're much more numerous, they don't have this all-important tribal membership. They just have an ID card that says Freedman, 00 blood, and voting rights only. And so they don't get to do anything else within the Seminole tribe. And they're really livid, these Black Seminoles, because they think that they should be full-fledged members of the Seminole Nation. And the Seminoles say, no, you shouldn't be. And it even came into COVID, where there was, at this clinic, there were these COVID shots being given, and a Black Seminole woman tried to get one, and she was told that she wasn't eligible because her ID card said voting rights only. She didn't get medical benefits. So what we see here is a situation where the Seminole really is not terribly interested in what we would call modern American concepts of racial egalitarianism. He's very much interested in his tribe surviving. And it's fascinating because obviously, you know, if whites were doing this in the U.S., there would be lawsuit after lawsuit and they would be condemned and this and that and the other thing. But in Seminole society, even though it's increasingly frowned upon, this separation is thought of as something that's just, I guess, part of life. But most people would have no idea that in the U.S. today, this sort of thing is still going on. And it, you know, it is what it is.
How did you think to write a book on this story? It's interesting to me as a historian, but it's not really, you know, with the exception of maybe the 1619 Project or something like that, it's not really drawn from today's headlines, which is where so many of books from on our side of the fence seem to be coming from these days.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned 1619, because that was one of the reasons why I decided to write the book. I am a native Floridian. I know a lot about Florida history. I really love it. The history of Florida is so complex, so enriching, and there are so many different people who've played a role in it that you can really learn about the whole world and the human condition just by learning about the story of Florida. But as to what prompted me to write the book, I had wanted to write a book about history that was relevant to people. I wrote the book not to read as like some, you know, textbook, but something that would read like an epic novel. And I hope I succeeded in that. The reviews have all been good thus far. So I feel that I have, but you know, there's always another perspective out there. And looking at the 1619 project, it was something so over the top and so absurd, boiling down to, like I said, the white man evil narrative where no one else did anything with slavery, that I knew it had to be challenged. And before writing anything, I looked to others who have tried to challenge it. And what I discovered was the 1776 narrative. And this, like the 1619 narrative, is a highly politicized, oversimplified version of American history. 1619 essentially ascribes collective guilt to all whites for slavery while ignoring everyone else who partook in slavery. 1776 essentially says that the founding fathers all had their ultimate vision fulfilled in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And that clearly is not where they were coming from. So I saw these two narratives that were not communicating the facts of history. And I also then realized my own limitations, because I don't know about the story of slavery in the whole of the U.S. well enough to write about it, but I did know about it in Florida, and I even wanted to learn more than what I already knew. And so that process is what led me to write Runaway Masters. And I think that I did succeed in communicating to people a story which they probably would not have known about. And I think I presented that story in as a reasonable and responsible manner as possible. It wasn't done as a political narrative. It certainly wasn't done as a polemic. It was just done as, I think, a very clear, concise, historical account. That's what I sought to disseminate to people. And I think the book lived up to my expectation. But no, I really just want people to be knowledgeable about stuff that took place, difficult as it might be to deal with. And I don't want them to fall victim to contemporary political narratives that distort history and manipulate it for the purpose of people who today want to gain political power. As the old saying goes, a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. And folks, you know, whether it's the 1776, but especially the 1619 narratives, there is a little bit of knowledge there. And it's very dangerous because it's grossly misused and people get a bad idea of what happened in the past. And they use that as a rationalization for unfortunate things in the present. And these people, of course, want to create a terrifying future.
Well, I definitely think the book is an important contribution, and I'm linking to it, of course, on our show notes page. That's tomwoods.com/1954. But tell me before you go, give people a sense of what you and Paul talk about on Cato Gottfried.
You know, it's a current event show, and obviously every time we do an episode, there's something different that we come up with, and the people who watch the show contribute to it sometimes, if they choose to. And it's fascinating because we never really know what it is we're going to get into until we're into it. Paul and I often have something that we just start discussing in the first few minutes of the show. But then the show, each episode takes a life of its own from there. And it makes things really unpredictable, which I think adds to the excitement. And it certainly prevents, you know, episodes of people listen to them. They're out as yours are out as podcasts after they're, you don't do the live stream, but Cato Gottfried does the live stream. But I think that there's so much diversity on the show in terms of content that it's hard to get bored listening to different episodes of Cato Gottfried. But we really, Paul and I, wanted to create a current event show where we would have an honest discussion about whatever it is that's going on in the world around us at any given time. And people could chime in with their insight, of course. And I think it creates for really, it's not just, you know, like something like Hannity and Combs used to be. First and foremost, because Paul and I, even though we have some big differences, we don't diverge nearly as much as Hannity and Combs did, but also because there's input from the audience and because it's a very intelligent conversation one way or the other, I think we provide something to people that they don't get elsewhere. And I hope that we leave them a bit more knowledgeable about what's going on in the world. And they certainly leave us more knowledgeable about it because of all the input we get from our audience. So I would say Cato Gottfried, I would say it lives up to its slogan, if you will, the current events show for the thinking man. And I would hope that people would agree with me who watch the show or who listen to it. And I think it has a very bright future, even though we live in this bizarre age of tech censorship, which leaves no stone unturned in a very bad way.
Well, from your lips to God's ear, let's say, on that particular wish that you have. And let's hope the same for the show we're on right now. So again, the book that we've been discussing, linked to tomwoods.com/1954, is Runaway Masters, A True Story of Slavery, Freedom, Triumph, and Tragedy Beyond 1619 and 1776 by Joseph Cotto, our guest today. Joe, thanks so much for your time and for the book.
And Tom, thank you very much for inviting me on. It's been a great conversation. You are an excellent host. And I think we really, some very complicated stuff in a very short period of time. Great discussion once again.
Thank you very much. All right, folks, before we wrap up for today, I have something that I think will benefit, let's just say, a lot of people listening to this right now. I have a listener named Ryan Pulice, and he started the Pulice Group. He is a liberty-loving CPA. He's trying to help people keep more of their own money without getting into trouble with the IRS. So he and his group specialize in creating custom tax plans for small business owners and real estate investors tailored to their unique circumstances. And he's currently offering free 30-minute consultations to listeners of the Tom Woods Show. So they'll interview you, review your prior year tax returns, determine if there are any tax planning opportunities. Full money-back guarantee. If you purchase a tax plan from them and are unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund their fee with no questions asked. You can reach them on the contact page of the website. So the website is the Pulice Group. That's P-U-L-I-C-E. So it's like police with a U. ThePuliceGroup.com. Contact page, as you'll see, is ThePuliceGroup.com/contact. And be sure to include a note that you heard about them on the Tom Woods Show. So I will link to thepulicegroup.com on the show notes page for today, tomwoods.com/1954. Take advantage of that offer, 30-minute consultation for nothing. Might as well go ahead and do that. And might as well go ahead and take advantage of my offer to you, which is to help you get a boost on that website you're thinking of starting. And I'll do that. All you got to do is get your hosting through my link, and I'll give you some nice benefits that are going to give you a great head start out of the gate. Details on how to get those and what all those benefits are over at tomwoods.com/publicity. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.